So, for the media people, my name is Doug Thorpe. I teach at Seattle Pacific University. And this is the third session on Leslie Stilfo's novel, Ceremony. And we are moving right to the center of the novel today. The plan is tomorrow to finish it, come right to the ending. I have left a couple of copies, Xerox copies, of key pages we'll focus on tomorrow in the library. Some of you have the book. Others who want to read it, those who own it, could, of course, rent it out for a nominal fee for a short period of time with an exorbitant interest rate if it comes back late. So that would be possible. Okay, and we've got a few more folks, and we've got one more copy. So we're going to have to start sharing a little bit.
This is the same as one of the pages I have here.
Okay. So at least there's the last part. And those of you who have been here, Kylie, you are late. See me in my office. So can somebody, this is a dangerous question, and we're holding, it's August, I'm going to ask if anybody remembers anything that we've talked about in the previous 2 days. What have we got? This is for folks who might just be joining in and don't really know the story.
She was dressed in blue.
She was dressed in blue.
I got thinking, you said with the water things.
Good. That will help clarify a lot. for everybody. I like that. That's the beginning of a poem.
Tales in search of some solution to some confusion.
Okay, so we've got a character, Teo. And what's Teo's background? What do we know about him?
He's a mixed-breed Indian.
Okay, Laguna Pueblo, southwest New Mexico Territory. Veteran of World War II, fought against the Japanese.
Mother died when he was very young.
He was very young. What do we know about his mother? Basically prostituted herself, died young, and
father unknown,
white father, okay. And so Teo is an outcast. He doesn't really fit in either society very well. I was just rereading an essay of Leslie Stilfo's about an hour ago, and she was talking about when she was young, there would be these white tourists who come through the Pueblo, through the reservation. And they would want to take pictures of the kids, of the Indian kids. So they would line up the Indian kids, smile, you know, take the picture, and then maybe give them a penny or something like that. And it was kind of, you know, a thrill for the kids. This is what Leslie Stilfo said. And what would happen to her, because she is mixed blood, what would happen to her is that these tourists would line up these kids, and Leslie would line up with them, and they would take her and move her out of the picture. No, not you. We want these real Indians.
Oh, wow.
I mean, astonishing. Yeah, we want the real Indians. So this is the heritage of our writer, who deeply identifies herself with the Pueblo tradition. So, Teo comes back from World War II, experiencing deep trauma. Treated in a VA hospital in Los Angeles. They really don't know what to do with him. He is unable or unwilling to speak. He is unable to keep food down. And so he is slowly dying. He's clearly slowly dying. And that inability to speak, in a novel that's all about the written word, the inability to speak is an inability to make contact, to make connection, to reach out, to have any kind of exchange, relationship. So Teo is profoundly cut off in that way. And the inability to eat, as we were saying yesterday, there is something he cannot stomach. And the image of the belly and vomiting comes up over and over again in the novel. And it's associated with alcohol as well. So Teo, we begin the novel in a place of trauma and a place of brokenness, a place where the main character profoundly needs healing. What we've been hearing in the Bible study last few days is this phrase from Romans 7, "O wretched man, who will," what is the line, "who will?"
Save me.
Good enough. Wow, this is terrible. Good thing Michael isn't here. Yes, that's the basic thing. So how will healing take place? How will healing take place? There's this beautiful passage in the law, beautiful in a horrible sort of way. Teo has a number of friends from the reservation. They're all long on the road to alcoholism. They spend pretty much all their time going to the nearest bar and just drinking and telling war stories. And it becomes an alternate ritual for them. It's very clearly put in the terms of a ritual. At one point, they're in an old car that's possibly breaking down. They pick up Teo, and they look at Teo, and they say, "Get this man to the Cold Coors Hospital. Get this man to the Cold Coors Hospital." And it's a humorous line. But in the context, of course, it's not particularly humorous. If you're actually dealing with somebody who has a serious drinking problem, using lines like that, images like that, using laughter, I mean, denies the profundity of what's lying beneath that addiction. And so Teo's friends are in no way in touch with the depth. Really, it's a spiritual problem. So yesterday, we were in the midst of a flashback before Teo went to the war. He had a healing experience going out into the mountains, conducting a ritual, a ceremony of sorts, that he had to partly make up because he wasn't really taught by his elders, much like Silva herself. And then he had an encounter with a woman named the Night Swan, who is hard to describe. But he had a sexual encounter with her. And the curious thing is that in the context of the novel, I think, my own sense at least, is that it was very healing. It was very healing. There was something, she was very much associated with the earth, with the rain, with the wind, and his association with her connected him back into that land and connected it in some way back to his mother. As strange as that seems, because he's having a sexual relationship, but there is something maternal about that. It is, in some ways, a return to this earth that he has been disconnected from. He's been disconnected from his place. He's been disoriented. And for Teo, some of the healing is going to take place by getting reoriented in a very literal way. So that's a flashback, and today we are picking up in a place where we're back in the present. Teo has not found any healing in the Laguna context, and so Old Man Kuish, who is the medicine man, the healer for the village, decides that he should go see another man named Batone. And Batone is also a healer, a medicine man, also a mixed blood, who lives farther away, up above one of the cities that is famous for, there's rodeos and so on in the summer, but it's a place also where a lot of the Native Americans come to congregate. And there's a lot of prostitution, a lot of alcoholism, and so on. And Batone has this place up above the city where he can, in a sense, look down and keep his eyes on what's going on. He's a very strange man. He collects phone books. He's got all these phone books from all these cities. All these phone books. And the phone books have names. Addresses. It's as if he's collecting all these names, as if he's collecting a lot of America in some ways. Trying to keep all of this together in one place. Teo is very skeptical about Tony. no idea really what he's getting into. But what he's there for is a ritual ceremony, in fact. And a couple pages before where your handout begins, we get this. They're camping out up on a hillside. They're on horseback. The mountain wind was cool. It smelled like springs hidden deep in mossy black stone. He could see no signs of what had been set loose upon the earth. The highways, the towns, even the fences were gone. This was the highest point on the earth. He could feel it. It had nothing to do with measurements or height. It was a special place. He was smiling. He felt strong. He had to touch his own hand to remember what year it was. Thick, welted scars from the shattered bottle glass when he was in the bar one day. And Emo proves this fairly demonic character who taunts Teo for being a half-breed. And Teo finally had enough. He smashed a bottle and stuck it in Emo's face. That violence that erupted in Teo is an aspect of the damage that he's experienced. This is the only way he knows how to respond to Emo. So that's the reference there. So there's this, I think, very striking contrast between that experience in the past, when all this rage was welling up in him, and what he experiences here. This was the highest point on the earth. I love that moment because you hit that line, and probably each one of us is thinking, oh no, it's not. It's not the highest point on the earth. It's not even, it's not Mount Rainier. But Silco, obviously she clarifies this right away. It had nothing to do with measurements or height. It was a special place. So what does this mean? What's the implication of this? It was the highest point on the earth. What is he experiencing?
I think he's ready to experience some of his native heritage.
Yeah, okay.
He's ready to accept something.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly getting back in contact with something. Yeah. And there's already a sense of healing in this moment. There's something about this place that resonates very deeply with him. It's the highest point. And of course, mythologically, many stories about highest points and the significance of highest points. All I have to do is think about Moses on the mountain and Sam and so forth. And there are just many, many stories, Mount Olympus and so on, none of which are literally the highest point. But for each culture, there's a sense in which this point is the highest, or variously, the center. This is the center of the world right here. And again, Silco would not need to take that literally. There are many centers. Of course, if you've been attending Chuck's lectures on Israel-Palestine, this is Jerusalem. Medieval maps, Jerusalem is literally depicted as the center of the cosmos of the earth. Everything comes together in Jerusalem. And as a symbol, that's a very powerful sense. Having been in Jerusalem, I know something of what that feels like, even though literally, I know that's not true. I keep offering these homework assignments, you might think about if you have a place. Is there a place that resonates like that? This is the center. When I was a kid, there were these weeping willow trees near my grade school. There were four of them organized almost in a rectangle. And a group of us would go there, and it's like we each claimed a tree. That was a long time ago, as you can guess. It's like a really long time. But a really powerful connection. So this is what Teo started to re-experience. This is the highest point. It was a special place. What it means is that he is getting reoriented. That's what you're reading.
He's getting reoriented.
And at that point, there's another gap in the text. And Silco starts to tell a story that, comes out of the Pueblo tradition that begins, his mother-in-law suspected something. She smelled coyote piss one morning. She told her daughter. She figured Coyote was doing this. She knew her son-in-law was missing. Coyote, in many tales, is a trickster figure. A little bit like in the Northwest, Raven is a kind of trickster figure, a creator, but also somebody who gets into trouble all the time, and so on. And so what Silco is doing is telling part of an actual Coyote Way ceremony. It's a healing ceremony for the Pueblo people. So she has embedded words from an actual ceremony. And there were other writers, Paula Gunn Allen, who's a very well-known Native American writer, who's also Leslie Silco's cousin, wrote an essay calling her out on this, saying, you have violated the boundaries of what you should be sharing. This is not public information. So what she's doing here is pushing the boundaries a little bit. But clearly it was important for her to embed this actual ceremony within the novel that is ceremony. I was saying yesterday that the novel is intended to be a kind of ceremony. It is intended to move one from a place of disorientation, fragmentation, brokenness, towards a place of healing, wholeness, and so on. And that's the function of the ceremony. It is to realign us. And again, think about communion, Eucharist, where you come in a certain place. And it may be that through that process, you again, at least briefly, get in touch with your own center. And that center is not you, but the Christ in you. So that's really, by analogy, what's starting to happen for Teo. We find out that they, what's happening is they're creating a sand painting. And if any of you have seen Navajo sand paintings, you'll have some sense of what this looks like. There's often circular in design. I mean, Teo would be placed inside of a circle, and the sand painting would have geometrical forms on it. Those geometrical forms would represent geological formations, the four directions, the mountains, and so on. In abstract ways, again, through geometrical lines and so on, they would place Teo in the center of that. This is what Silco says right before the Xerox. He sat in the center of the white corn sand painting. The rainbows crossed were in the painting behind him. The Tony's helper scraped the sand away. So again, Silco is giving us an actual sand painting ceremony here. So that we are, it's as if we are in what is now a sacred space. We have walked into sacred space. As soon as she starts telling the Coyote Way ceremony, we have entered the temple. Temple in its Indo-European origins means a space cutout. It was originally used in terms of divining and augury. They would cut out a space, sometimes it would be a space in a forest, so you could read the stars and so on. So right at the core of the word temple is this notion of a holy space cut out from the surroundings. And the word contemplation, same root, of course. And so in a way, the sand painting really forms a sacred space for this work to be done. And part of the work is the telling of the story, which is what's happening here. So we pick up on 142, which is where finally we've arrived at the handout. And if somebody would pick up at the top of 142 where it says, the painter, or the helper, worked in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
is it in the book?
131.
131 in that book?
Did everybody see where I am?
Yeah. Help, help me.
Okay.
The helper worked in the shadows beyond the dark mountain range. He worked with the black sand, making bear prints side by side. Along the right side of the bear footprints, the old man painted paw prints in blue, and then yellow, and then finally white. They finished it together with a big rainbow arching wide above all of the mountain range. Tony gave him a basket with prayer sticks to hold.
Okay. And then Tony starts to chant. And it's hard to reproduce this. Anybody want to give it a shot? We got any extroverts here? So this is all set as if in poetry, centered on the page. In dangerous places you traveled, in danger you traveled to, a dangerous place you traveled, endangered, to the place where whirling darkness started its journey, along the edges of the rocks, along the places of the gentle wind, along the edges of blue clouds, along the edges of clear water. Whirling darkness came up from the north. Whirling darkness moved along to the east. It came along the south. It arrived in the west. Whirling darkness spiraled downward, and it came up in the middle. Shift froze. The helper stepped out from the shadows. He was grunting like a bear. He raised his head as if it were heavy for him, and he sniffed the air. He stood up and walked a tail. He reached down for the prayer sticks and spoke the words distinctly, pressing the sticks close to his heart. The old man came forward then and cut Teo across the top of his head. It happened suddenly. He hadn't expected it, but the dark flint was sharp and the cut was short. They both reached for him then, lifting him up by the shoulders. They guided his feet into the bear prints, and Petone prayed him through each of the five hoops. Hey, hey, Anna. 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 And remember, they're out in the middle of the wilderness, up on a hilltop. Teo is inside of this space. There's only Petone and his helper. And the suddenness of this experience, I mean, it's, you get a sense, it's a powerful ceremony. The bear, one of the things that we're told is that in the Coyote Way ceremony, in this old story, there is a young man, this son-in-law, who disappears one day. And so the beginning of that story, the mother smells coyote piss. It's the track of the coyote. It's the coyote's mark. Right? So there's this indication that this young man has been enchanted or has followed the coyote, has gone with the coyote clan, you could say. And the mother-in-law and the wife wonder what to do. And they decide, we're going to go to the bear people. Only the bear people can help us. Because the bear people are close to the human and have a certain kind of power, which is not too hard to understand. I mean, those of you who've seen bears in the wild have some sense of the power of these creatures. And there are many stories also of humans who have gone with bears and have become bear and indicated the relationship between the human and the bear. So in this story, it is the bear people that they go to, who then help this young man, who track him down to where he has been lured away by the coyote. And Tony's helper is named Shush, and that name Shush references him back in the Navajo language to bear. Shush, the helper, is one who has himself been drawn into the bear clan in some sense. Now, if you want to translate that in a way, you can say, well, this is like Teo, or this is like one of us, perhaps, who is living what appears to be a normal life, and then something occurs. And it's as if we are drawn away, drawn into a different life, drawn into a different way of being. And there's something dangerous about that. We can get lost out there, and that happens sometimes to people. They get lost out in that place that has drawn them away from their own clan, from the human. But there's also something potentially very powerful about that as well. Those who have crossed boundaries like that, in turn, become healers, often. And Shush is one of those characters. There is something, as the novel describes him, there's something that sets him apart, that will always set him apart. And so there's something painful about that, because it's not easy for him to mix with regular society, so to speak. But he also is somebody with a gift. He has been deeply gifted, and so he becomes Petone's helper. To me, it's a powerful metaphor about just recognizing people who are just a little different, just a little different. And that could be a difficult thing to be in our culture. It's true. Yeah. Where I teach can be a difficult thing. And probably where most people teach can be a difficult thing. I mean, there's a particular kind of culture and a way of being. And if you don't fit, it is a little bit like you've been lured away by the coyote or the bear. I felt this myself in high school. I was a competitive swimmer. And so as a swimmer, as an athlete, as a jock, as a guy, it was a way in which I fit in very easily. But there was a side of me that on the team bench I would be reading T.S. Eliot. It was very strange. My friends, God, what are you doing? It's like one time I almost missed my event because I was down in the locker room reading The Wasteland. It was this tension that I felt when I was 16, 17 years old. And I think that's not uncommon. It's not that uncommon. And so this character Shush is a little bit like that. You get pulled into these other worlds mysteriously. And there's something very powerful about that. But it can be risky. And so it is Shush who lays out the bear prints. And then Teo is invited to step into those paws. It's part of his healing. Because those bear prints are going to lead him away from where he has been, where he has disappeared into, and to lead him back home. And if you turn the page, well, actually at the bottom of 133, you begin to get that. At the dark mountain, born from the mountain, walked along the mountain, I will bring you through my hoop, I will bring you back. That is the bear speaking to the patient. Following my footprints, walk home. Following my footprints, come home. Happily return, belonging to your home. Return to long life and happiness again. Return to long life and happiness. Ehe-ya-ana, 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 ehe-ya-ana. I have the dew, a sunray falls from me, I was born from the mountain, I leave a path of wildflowers, a raindrop falls from me, I'm walking home. I'm walking back to belonging. I'm walking home to happiness. I'm walking back to long life. So it moves from that first person, where there's this invitation to really step into. And as you, I can feel that as I'm reading that aloud, suddenly I am in Teo's footsteps, so to speak. That I'm walking home. I'm walking back to belonging. And so in doing that, especially reading as aloud, but even to an extent, reading it on the page, as you inhabit that I, you are inhabiting the ceremony that Teo is going through. There may be just a little bit of that sense. In part, the repetition, the chant-like quality of that. And then it shifts back outward to a different perspective. When he passed through the last hoop, it wasn't finished. They spun him around sunwise, and he recovered. He stood up. The rainbows returned him to his home, but it wasn't over. All kinds of evil were still on him. Which is a suggestion that it's not that the ceremony has failed, but it's a recognition that there is a depth to the trauma, that it's going to require more work. There is more to be done. We're only halfway through the novel, though.
When
is
that written still in the poetic style?
Yeah, it's still, it's as if...
What was the question?
Oh, I was wondering why that's still written in the poetic style. That last little part, when he passed through the last hoop.
Well, and I'll let you try to answer it. Do you have any sense?
No.
What's the impact of it? What difference does it make?
He's still convinced of what's happening. So yeah, as the oral tradition goes, this is how the word is spoken.
Okay. And
he's still right in the middle of his journey.
Yes.
He's coming out, but he hasn't left it.
Right. So there is a difference between that stanza or paragraph and what happens next from the last hoop they led him through the doorway. Again, in asking that kind of question, it's not that I have an absolute answer. All I go back to is, what's my experience? What's my experience of reading that in that stanza for me, as opposed to if it were simply written out in the normal paragraph? That's really what I have to go on. And of course, you know, there may be further information from Silpo or the traditions or whatever, but primarily, you have your own experience of it. And the invitation, this is me as English Prophet 101, right? You know, it's just, okay, how does that make you feel? What's the difference?
I think there's more emotion to it when it's put to rhythm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Grabs you.
It does. I think it grabs you in a particular way. You can do this exercise with a poem. Take a stanza poem that you love and write it out as a prose paragraph. It's the same words, but you'll experience it very differently.
It also makes a difference to read it out loud.
That's true. Yeah, it really does. Yeah. So from the last hoop, they led him through the doorway. It was dark and the sky was bright with stars. The chill touched the blood on his head. His arms and legs were shaking, and so on. So they led him through the doorway. It's dark, the sky was bright with stars. The doorway is a threshold, and there is a kind of birth, an emerging from this womb-like experience, which the ceremony recreates. There is a re-entering. We were talking a little bit about the cathedral yesterday. And it's a little bit like that, cathedral as this mother space. And so Teo is being drawn out of that, is re-emerging. I teach Dante, so I hear Dante in lines like this, because the end of the Inferno, which I'm sure you remember vividly. Oh yeah, of course. I reread it every year. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. Dante has gone
gave you this underworld experience, this whole book-length experience. He's gone to the center of the earth where he finds Satan frozen in ice. Dante's hell is cold. It's cold-blooded. There's no life. There's no passion. And so he finds Satan there at the very center of the earth. And he literally, guided by Virgil, he climbs on Virgil's back, the great Roman poet. And Virgil turns him upside down, because they're at the center of the earth, the point of gravity. Turns upside down, and they start climbing up the other side of the earth through the tunnel that was made when Satan was thrown out of heaven. See, I'm trying to talk to you in the reading. There's this tunnel that's made as Satan plummets from heaven, hits the earth, and goes shooting right up into the middle of the earth and gets stuck there. If you try to picture that. And so Dante and Virgil literally use the body of Satan to climb out of hell. It's really a powerful image. They have seen the face of sin. They have recognized it fully. And it becomes a vehicle in a strange way. Because they've seen it. They've seen through it. It no longer has power over them. Satan is impotent. He's frozen in ice. It's really remarkable. And he climbs up, and he starts to see from the center of the earth. It's nighttime. And he looks up through that tunnel, and he sees the stars. It's really not unlike this moment of Teo emerging out of his space and seeing the stars. He dreamed about the speck of cattle on the top of the floor. He dreamed about the speck of cattle. Okay, so we haven't talked about the speck of cattle. Some of you have been reading the book. Can you clue us in as to what these speck of cattle are?
Mexican cattle that Josiah bought?
Yes.
They took and got these cattle that wouldn't stay in the man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Josiah bought these speckled or spotted cattle. In spite of, this is before the war, before they went off to the war, and Josiah is trying to think about what kind of cattle will really work on this rather barren land. And so he's come up, in part, it's through the Night Swan, who gets him in touch with someone who sells him these cattle that look kind of scrawny. But as Josiah says, I mean, you need cattle that basically live on dirt. They have to be a particular kind. And spotted suggests, again, a kind of mixed breed.
Well, they bred them with Herefords.
Hmm?
They were supposed to be bred with Herefords.
Right.
So they were going to get bigger the next generation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So the spotted cattle, as this mixed breed, in a certain sense, represent Teo himself, and the fact that the spotted cattle have scattered all over the place, and what Teo finds out is that they have in fact been stolen and placed behind fences of the white ranchers. So finding the spotted cattle, what happens in the second half of the novel, as part of Teo's literal journey and also healing, is finding those spotted cattle. In a certain sense, it's not unlike this young man who was drawn off by the coyote and who needs to be searched for and brought back. So Teo now is going to be the active member who is going off in search of these spotted cattle. In another sense, he is searching for the pieces of himself that he needs to regather, which he does successfully, ultimately. In the middle of that page, he's standing on the edge of the rim rock, looks down below the canyons and the valleys. He remembered the black of the sand paintings on the floor of a hogan. The hills and mountains were the mountains and hills they had painted in sand. He took a deep breath of cold mountain air. There were no boundaries. The world below and the sand paintings inside became the same that night. The mountains from all the directions had been gathered there. There were no boundaries. One of the things he's alluding to is that what Teo
recognizes and experiences is that when he is placed in the center of this sand painting is a symbolic representation of the landscape. The mountains in various directions. I mean, there are these recognizable landmarks. And placing him in the center of that sand painting is, in a very real sense, reorienting him. So in this sacred space, he reconnects with his place, with where he belongs. He knows where he is again. The inside and outside are one. So he is in this space, and then he leaves the hogan, he reemerges, and what he experiences back out in the world as he looks around is exactly what he experienced in the sand pit. Just that it's this, it's full scale, you might say. He knows where he is. Yeah. So, by analogy again, if you think of that as the church or the cathedral, or whatever place it is where you find your orientation. Well, the goal is that you do get reoriented in this space. And one argument is, and I think this is the argument that Silko was trying to make, is that that sacred space you can possibly find in a book. You might locate it in a work of art, including in this novel Sandman. Does that make sense? It's very important, I think. And it's a leap. I'm not sure if it really makes sense or not. But I do think that's what Silko was arguing. You enter this novel, and you enter in a place of disorientation. As those of you who are here on Monday experienced it. And little by little, it starts, the pieces of the puzzle, or the threads, which is really closer to Silko's metaphor, those threads start to get untangled and start to take form, start to form a pattern that begins to make sense. Teo, through, and then within the ceremony that's within the ceremony of the novel, right at the center point, Teo's really beginning to see the pattern of his life and how it fits in with something larger. He is finding meaning where he had felt simply chaos and meaninglessness. Yeah.
I kind of felt from reading the book that he never really did feel oriented prior to leaving for war. That he never really was a part of the Native American culture.
Yes.
His aunt wouldn't let him be.
Yeah.
And his Josiah tried his best, but he never gave him the initiation ceremonies or the part of growing up being a young man. He was an outcast. And
yes,
this felt to me like this was his initiation into his clan or his people, or that he had at least a center to start from.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that a memory of that day when he went out into the mountains and did that little ritual is about as close as he got, which is why that memory surfaces for him. I mean, that's what he holds on to right following the memory of the death of his mother and that experience of the candy cane. So there's a very clear immediate juxtaposition between the failure of a Christian ritual, a Christian experience, that is Christmas, which is the birth of life in the world. For Teo, in his context, that clearly holds no meaning. But neither does he have much to reach for or to ground himself in the tribal traditions. But he has at least enough memory connection to be able to go out into the mountains to remember a little bit. And he has this momentary experience of reconnection. But essentially, you're right. He really is, he is a wanderer. He is an outcast. And so it is this experience with Potomac, really for the first time, that he's getting integrated.
And it's through somebody who, again, is an outcast. But Tony tells his own story, his own family history, a series of people who were different, who didn't fit in, like the Night Swan. And so the novel is suggesting that there's a whole group of people who aren't recognized by society, but have, in part because of that marginalization, have a kind of awareness and insight that is really important for the healing, not just of the individual, but the implication is for a larger culture. Because the novel is suggesting that the larger culture, certainly our culture, is deeply in need of healing. So the next section we have in the handout takes him to another woman. He has gone off in search of the cattle. And this should be page 180. Is that you? Have you got that?
167.
It's 167 in that book? Thank you. He arrives. He's looking for the cattle. He comes to this house. There's a woman there who invites him in. And we find out later that the woman's name is Tse Montaña. And the last name shouldn't be particularly confusing. Tse Montaña. I think it's Montaña rather than Montaña. Obviously, her name aligns her with the mountains. And Tse is a word that is associated with water, and might also be associated with Tsitsinako, which is Thought Woman, at the beginning of the novel. The implication is that this woman, even more than Night Swan, and this is to our culture peculiar. It's a woman that, again, he makes love with. There is this physical embodiment, but she also, very clearly in the novel, represents a supernatural being. She represents, she is an embodiment, an incarnation, if you want to put it that way, of this creative source and creative force, who is there in some ways to be a guide for him, to be an aid for him. As he is beginning to move more and more deeply into his path, into his healing, there is some sense in which this figure now shows up in a very real way to assist him. And that's what we're getting here. And again, to our ears, this is peculiar. But I think that's what we're to sense. So page 180, let's see. And in the other edition?
167
again. He washed her face, her eyes never shifted. They were with him while she moved out of her clothes. She slipped his jeans down his legs, struggled his thighs. She unbuttoned his shirt. This is all very clearly erotic. All he was aware of was the heat of his own breathing and the warmth radiating from his belly, pulsing between his legs. He was afraid of being lost, so he repeated trail marks to himself. This is my mouth tasting the salt of her brown breasts. This is my voice calling out to her. He eased himself deeper within her and felt the warmth close around him like river sand, softly giving way underfoot, then closing firmly around the ankle in cloudy, warm water. But he did not get lost. And so on. And I'm reading it aloud so that we can get some sense of how Silpo is merging profoundly erotic scene with a scene that also suggests this natural force. There is this, especially this water, like we were saying. So he repeated trail marks to himself. So this also suggests that this body that he is moving into and moving with is the land, and the trail marks are his way through that land. So simultaneously,
And we would call that a metaphor. Right? Oh, it's a figure of speech. Really what's happening is he is having sex with this woman. But Silco really wants it both ways. And to me, again, the writing is very powerful here, where you do get the sense that that body is that land, is that water. And if you want a comparison again, when's the last time you read the Song of Songs in the Old Testament? It's all these extraordinary metaphors for primarily, it's both the bodies of the man and the woman. It's the only text in the Old Testament that does not name God anywhere. It does not name God anywhere. And yet, one of the greatest of rabbis said of all the texts of the Hebrew Bible, the Song of Songs is the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies, meaning within the temple, it is that place where the high priest would go once a year within the temple. And anybody who violated that would be killed. It is the Holy of Holies, this most sacred of places. This poem that is purely erotic. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So it's, again, not unlike what Silco was inviting us into here. The woman in the Song of Songs is referred to as this garden, fountain of living water. Fountain, she's a fountain of living water. Very beautiful. Language, of course, is picked up in John's Gospel to represent Jesus. And we are just about out of time, I think. You know, in my description of this, I was suggesting, you know, making some connections to wisdom tradition and the feminine and the Christian kind of that. So by talking about the Song of Songs, I've at least hinted at that. There's a way in which this figure in Silco, you know, again, thought woman, Cicinato, a feminine creative force, which in the Laguna Pueblo tradition really is the creative force. And women were highly valued. Silco, one of Silco's essays talks about the power that women held in that community, including just work. You know, her grandmother you know, would be working at houses, did carpentry, did all, I mean, just all these different activities that were traditionally in a Western culture thought of as man. So there is this notion of this earth as an alive, feminine body that is also profoundly spiritual and profoundly healing. And again, if you want to make a translation, you do have this figure in what's called the wisdom tradition in Hebrew and in Christianity. You go to Proverbs 8, many of these wisdom parables, wisdom stories about this figure who was with God in the beginning of creation, and in a sense through whom creation came to be. And there are a lot of theologians, not just feminist theologians, but lots of theologians, who look at the Logos language in the Gospel of John and trace that language about Jesus as Logos right back to that wisdom tradition in Proverbs and in the Wisdom of Solomon. So the Logos takes on some of that same characteristic in John's Gospel. So there is this this place within you know, the Hebrew and Christian tradition as well for this figure. Let's see. I gave out this poem, which perhaps we will read just to finish off. And I might use it again on Friday. And I'm not sure if we have enough. We probably don't. This is a poem by a friend of Leslie Silco's, Joy Harjo, also a Native American writer, called Eagle Poem. Tomorrow, again, we will finish up and we'll find that as Teo has moved through this experience of healing and finding the cattle, he is confronted at the end with Emo and these friends of his who are in the midst of a kind of violent ritual. And Teo has to make a very difficult decision about how to play this out. And it takes place not far from Los Alamos. It's connected to the development of the nuclear bomb. And so it's part of Teo's discovery of this underlying pattern that he has been living within, a demonic pattern in part. But there's also this other side to it that is healing, that has to do with this sunrise to sunrise. So that these are shadow and light, as we will see tomorrow. So Eagle Poem,
July Fire Joe. And it is a prayer.
It is a prayer. To pray you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you, and know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know, except in moments steadily growing and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Like Eagle that Sunday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky, in wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, see ourselves, and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this. And breathe, knowing we are truly blessed because we were born and die soon within a true circle of motion, like Eagle rounding out the morning inside us. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. And that ending is an intentional echo or allusion to one of the Navajo night chants, the ceremonies. It speaks of walking in beauty, and the repetition of that is to reinforce. So there's again something ritualistic chanting in this lovely poem. Okay. Vespers is right around the corner. Thank you all so much for coming.